South Africa speaks the language of moral authority in global affairs, human rights, mediation, constitutionalism. But moral authority depends on credibility, and credibility depends on capacity. Today, we explore what happens when those two drift apart and what that gap means for ordinary South Africans. Joining me in studio to give us context and clarity is Mr. Frank Ndwali, a human rights lawyer who represents Rwandan opposition voices in exile here in Southern Africa as chairperson of the Rwanda National Congress, and Mr. Ricardo Teixeira, a defense analyst and policy commentator who has long argued that South Africa's military and strategic capacity are in steep decline. So this conversation sits right at the intersection of principle and power. I will start with asking you, Frank, the question first. South Africa positions itself as this defender of human rights and, you know, this moral authority. From your perspective, sitting in exile, do you think that South Africa really is that? And is this country doing enough to support your cause?
Thank you so much, Bumis. I think that's very true, because looking at the continent as it is, you find very few countries still stand for the values they believe in, like South Africa. And this is evidenced by the refugee influx in South Africa. Even people coming from East Africa, people coming from West Africa, you find them in South Africa, simply because it's what South Africa says it stands for. And when the refugees are here, they feel safe, protected, and they cannot be mistreated. They cannot be judged. Mm-hmm. So whatever case it would be, you find that they are so comfortable here than actually most, if not the only country on the continent now that really defends human rights.
So that then, you know, for me, always raises the question, gentlemen, of this kind of this moral authority role that we've taken and what that truly means in geopolitics. When you think about what geopolitics, particularly on the continent, in the SADC region, what does that really mean? And can South Africa back it up? Anyone?
I think you can take the what does it mean, I'll take the back it up.
Okay.
Yeah, clearly what it means. Let's take an example, because to understand this in context is indeed to understand it in the geopolitical question you're asking. Mm. Let's first see, where do these problems come from? We will talk about it, your DRC, your Rwanda, your where these refugees come. But look at their backyard, what is happening. It's conflicts over conflicts, because they cannot come together to solve their own internal politics. But then they have exported this conflict to the level that you find that the diplomacy, which is supposed to solve matters, is actually a lie and carried behind the whole thing. If you take an example of Rwanda in itself, where it has most of the refugees, I think, on the continent. What happens? It imports violence in other countries. Coupling us to what we saw in Cap Delgado here, soldiers here in Central African Republic. But when you look at its own internal dynamics, is it peaceful? How do you give what you do not have? The neighbor in Congo, it is now evidence, it is proven that there is no M23, actually it's RDF, Rwanda Defense Forces, which creates this whole chaos of refugees, of conflict. Then you find that that burdens South Africa, SADC as you are talking about. Why is that? They do not bring themselves to sit and have to iron out those issues, but they prey on the vulnerability of neighbors.
So you talk DRC, Rwanda, and that particular conflict. And it is the premise for this conversation, because here we sit, January, at this time, 2 years ago, we watched quite a disastrous mission.
1 year ago.
It was only one year ago. 2026.
Yeah, it was 2025.
2025, you're correct. Yeah. So here we are on the anniversary of a peacekeeping mission that went completely awry. And you're well known for a very loud voice in this space and the understanding of that. Can we back it up?
Short answer right now, no. Long answer, we need to look at the framing of the mission. You know, and I'm expecting to hear it again from the president next week in his SONA speech. South Africa's regional foreign policy is characterized by a single phrase that the Department of International Relations and Cooperation and the President and the Department of Defense have used for many years across several administrations. And it is a phrase that gives me a headache every time I hear it. And it is contributing towards silencing the guns, because the only ones that have gone silent are our own. Now, if we look at SAMI DRC, the mission in the Eastern DRC, that was not a peacekeeping mission. It was a peace enforcement mission. And the Minister of Defense saying, you know, we didn't take all our equipment because we were there to keep the peace, shows two things. Firstly, she doesn't understand the mission. Secondly, they don't understand what a fair fight is. Because if you're going into something like this, you don't want a fair fight. You know, if you are planning for a fair fight, you're planning to lose. Mm. If we look at the South African National Defense Forces performance in the Eastern DRC, one thing we need to remember is we've been there since 1998. Okay, we've been there under Operation Mistral since the end of the Congo War and as an after effect of the Rwandan genocide, the instability in the region. We were pulled in and we thought we were going to be there not too long, but here we are, going on 28 years later, still in the Eastern DRC. We've done more rotations to the Eastern DRC than America did to Afghanistan. So it is, in its own way, become our own little forever war. There has been a bit of a mission creep, because in the beginning we were there under MONUC, and then it eventually evolved into MONUSCO and the establishment of the Force Intervention Brigade under the United Nations, which was its only, for a while, and still is, the only United Nations mission with an offensive mandate. It's not peacekeeping, it is peace enforcement. Now, when we look at the Force Intervention Brigade, its makeup, it's South Africa, Tanzania, and Malawi. Okay, you got a brigade where South Africa provides the bulk of the combat power with a composite helicopter unit, tactical intelligence, medical unit, infantry battalion, special forces. But under that, in the last decade or so, from about 2014, it was actually quite successful. In 2014, at the Battle of, the hill north of Goma, the Force Intervention Brigade and South Africa's involvement, they actually expelled M23 back into Rwanda. And we had a while where it looked like, you know, they'd actually achieved their goal. But the mission went on, it dragged on, and they experienced something which you often see in these sorts of combat deployments, which is mission creep, where the end goal and the goalpost just keeps moving. And eventually you don't really understand, like, what are we still trying to achieve? And I think that is the biggest problem with South Africa's foreign policy in the Eastern DRC is now, 28 years later, we still don't really know what we're trying to achieve. What does success look like? When are we going to say we've done enough?
Frank, this is home for you. And this is part of the work that you do, is talking very much about the environment within Rwanda, in the border with their neighbor. And you were just talking about the fact that when you don't have internal peace and stability, you export that. What do you think South Africa got wrong or did not understand about that region, going in there for peace enforcement or peacekeeping, depending who you ask? What did they get wrong, and what should they have learned from that?
Thank you so much. You know, let's be very clear. Actually, you cannot keep peace when there's no peace. So maybe we can say they're going to enforce it. Now, South Africa, number one, it got the intelligence wrong. Because from the inception, it thought it's going to enforce peace, whereby it really believed, because of wrong intelligence, either deliberately or they did not want to believe the fact that M23, these are not rebels. So when they went there, they would have known they are going to face a sovereign country, which is Rwanda, because Rwanda has invaded Congo. Now, from that inception, the preparation, the enforcement, at all levels, they would have known that they're going to challenge another sovereign country, which is in the region, which South Africa did not understand or deliberately ignored that. So getting there It was faced with the might of Rwanda Defense Forces, which indeed, you're going to enforce peace where peace doesn't exist. And what are you going to do? You're going to fight. So clearly, South Africa would have known that we are not going into this as a peacekeeping mission, which basically they misread. Mm-hmm. And now I had the Minister of Defense saying that they were shooting bullets all over our heads. So what did you expect?
That statement still makes me furious. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the footage, you look at a lot of the photos that I've seen and been sent, and a lot of the people that were there on the SANDF site that I've spoken to, when they heard that, they were furious, saying that, no, they were just shooting over us. That was war. That was some of the most intense combat our troops have seen in the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And for the minister to say, oh, no, it was a misunderstanding, they were shooting over us, again showed a complete lack of understanding and awareness of what exactly was going on the ground. And I agree with what Frank said, that it was an intelligence failure. Even the people I've spoken to from the tactical intelligence unit, when they were on the ground, arriving in May 2024 for their rotation of the deployment, the one individual I spoke to said he got off the runway in Goma, he made his way to Sake, and then the sun started going down and he noticed all the hills overlooking the base, there were little fires. So from the moment he arrived, M23 had the high ground. They were overlooking the base, they had the positions, and he said, you know, okay, we need to capture those hills back, you know, we need to make a plan, do probing attacks, see where their weaknesses are, see what sort of presence they have up there, and then we need to capture the high ground. Because from a tactical and operational level, the bases at Goma and Sake were terrible choices. Okay, you got right on the border with Rwanda on the east side of Goma. And on the south side, you've got Lake Kivu. So there's nowhere to withdraw to. You're literally stuck.
You're hemmed in.
You have to move forward. You have to take the fight to the enemy. And SANDF didn't do that. And they felt it wasn't a concern. And that, I still can't believe that the one officer told me when he proposed that they do an attack up the hill, they said, no, we're going to get hit by mortars.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what you're here for. And this is, again, the failure of understanding the nature of the mission, that they were there to fight.
So there is, on the one hand, there is South Africa wanting to be this moral authority, but with all of the problems that SANDF faces, as we've heard over and over from many different sources, underfunding, machinery that's out of commission and outdated, essentially a defense force that cannot keep up, and to your point, Frank, with another sovereign state that has probably a more sophisticated military, as it would seem, right? But there is also a political tension between Kigali and Pretoria, right? You yourself living here under threat, essentially, court cases at the Randburg Magistrates Court about death squads or supposed death squads and inquiries. How safe, firstly, are you and the leadership of RNC in South Africa, and in terms of the tension, the diplomatic tension, can South Africa still play this peacekeeper, this this role of being the sane one or the adult in the room?
Let me just give this a bit of a context so that people can actually understand what we're dealing with here, the white elephant in the room. Rwanda is the destabilizing factor, not of Rwanda itself, not East Africa, but Africa at large. What does this mean in itself? He says for more than 20 years, Rwanda has practically occupied Congo. And this is evidence from the region, from the international community, everybody knows. Rwanda has fought several wars with Uganda in Congo. Rwanda has fought with Burundi today. And Rwanda has fought Tanzanians in Congo. Now, South Africa should have known that the behavior of Rwanda is not a country that you can deal with diplomatically. You talked about our issues here. Rwanda is a country which states shamelessly that why is a country having army in another country? So what's your problem? where do you come in that situation? If Burundi has forces in Congo, this is a bilateral relationship. But Kagame states and questions, why are Burundi forces in Congo? I mean, he told it to Ramaphosa. Like, why did you take your soldiers to Congo? So he believes he has monopoly to Congo and monopoly to kill whoever he wants, to assassinate whoever in this country. That's why the relationship South Africa and Rwanda went sour. Why? Not because of South Africa. Rwanda came to kill refugees. Irrespective of the international conventions, international law, sovereignty, bigger South Africa is, Rwanda feels brave enough to come and kill refugees in South Africa. So now, when we are talking about Rwanda, it's a country which does not expect the rule of law. Democracy, that's none of its business. But does not respect sovereignty of other countries. So now, that's why it feels that South Africa cannot stop them to come here in South Africa to kill its so-called dissidents. Because for you, when you oppose or say anything about Rwanda, you're a terrorist. It disregards the international norms, international law, and it has unilateral decisions to come here and kill. So South Africa expelled Rwandan diplomats because they had killed, let Patrick Karegeya, shot General Kayumba, stabbed me several times. So now this, its policy is to pursue the so-called dissidents or people opposite. So now South Africa, by going to Congo, it would have known that the country it's dealing with. He talked about Goma. You see, Goma and Gisenyi, for those who may not know, when you're in Rwanda, that border that borders Rwanda and Congo, Gisenyi is those mountains you're overlooking, Goma. So meaning if the RDF had already deployed strategically, there is a banana plantation that actually joins Goma from Gisenyi. So Rwandan defense forces were coming. South Africa, do not tell people what happened exactly. They lost so much equipment in the hands of Rwanda defense forces. But now, you say the safety. The safety, South Africa has tried to speak with two tongues. It knows that Rwanda is a problem. It's not a country you can have diplomatic ties with based on the truth and negotiations because it doesn't negotiate. But will South Africa stand up to its name, to its values, to refuse such a country which has chosen a way of aggression to keep destabilizing Africa, keep killing people in their own yard? So our safety, we challenge South Africa that according to the international law, they must enforce the peace. They must keep the peace. They must create the peace.
So you are on the one hand, talking about a moral expectation for an intervention from South Africa, right? A moral expectation. And you, on the other hand, are saying, well, we don't have the ability to enforce this or carry this out. You know, on the one hand, you are talking about a moral expectation for South Africa to stand up in the region and enforce its moral authority. But you're talking about a shrinking ability of being able to ensure that that happens. So a guy on the streets, if you're a guy like me, I'm a girl from Soweto, if you're a guy from, you know, Khayelitsha or Mamelodi, what does this then mean, this gap between ability to enforce and this expectation of a nation like South Africa? What does this mean for me on the street?
So I think, and I agree with Frank, that we don't just have the moral responsibility, but we have the regional responsibility as the largest economy in the region to do these sorts of missions. In fact, I can think of several meetings between chiefs of defense forces going back that some of my mentors have been in, where an admiral from Ghana remarked that South Africa submarines were not South Africa's, they were Africa's. That they was our submarines, and that there was this regional belief that South Africa was going to stand up for everyone and to work with everyone. And the ambition has been reinforced by the 2024 National Security Strategy. If you read that, there is a clear outlining of ambition there for what South Africa is supposed to do in the region. But the implementation of that policy is far off. And in a way, in my opinion, it is the result of ANC policy, in that they've put forward this ambition, but they've failed to deliver and failed to meet it. And you, it's clear as day in the Department of Defense. And if you look at the underfunding of our defense force, so we have this, the region that expects so much from us. But then we look at our defense budget and how the Department of Defense is run, and you can see that there is somehow, there's this severe mismatch between what the government wants to do and what it ends up doing.
So are we funding foreign ambitions and trading it up for internal security and services?
Well, I made this argument once that, and I mean, the defense minister herself did say to me when I interviewed her in 2024 at Lohatla, it was her first time at a military exercise. And, you know, I asked her about it and she said she was humbled because she'd never asked a teacher to put their lives on the line. But now she's in charge of defense. And she said, you know, for years I would ask if every budget discussion, you know, defense doesn't need the money, give it to education. And the Department of Health said the same. And I made the argument that if we look at our defense budget and then compare our education budget, our policing budget, and our health budget, given that we cut defense to fund those, with the current state of our healthcare and our education and our police, was that sacrifice worth it? And I think that is not a question for me to answer. I think that is a question for the government to answer. We see now all the problems with our education, our healthcare, and the Mudlanga Commission. I still don't understand how the Department of Finance at the end of last year, in the medium term, gave SAPS a 13 billion rand increase, more than 10%, despite everything coming out of the Mudlanga Commission. I don't know how you can sell that to the public, that seeing everything going on in SAPS, that somehow they decided, you know what they need? More money. When we look at the responsibility and the expectation put on our defense force, they are literally being asked to do more with less, and it's just not possible.
Yeah, and so what I mean, foreign policy isn't, it's about priorities.
It's about budget, priorities.
It's about all of that. But also, Frank, for you as a refugee, as a person that has been termed, and we know this here in South Africa well, right? Our freedom fighters were termed terrorists all over the world, right? You are here in South Africa going on 25 years now. Do you think that it is still worth it to be fighting this fight from so far away from home?
Certainly. If I didn't believe it, I wouldn't be doing it. But you see, history doesn't lie. You see, nobody has ever changed their internal problems by just starting internally. You can look at South Africa, you can look at Cuba, you can look at Uganda, several examples. So what does that mean in itself? You see, you can only deal with this matter through diplomacy. Diplomacy must explain to countries to understand. Fortunately, no one doesn't understand Rwanda. They understand it, but the question is what can be done about it? That's number one. Number two, when they think it is the problem of only Rwandans, they will only realize that actually it will affect them in the long run. How? If you are a country and you cannot enforce your international obligations, what does that tell you? If you're a country and cannot be able to keep people who come in your country protected, what does that tell you as a country? Because I think Marema put it correctly, that whatever happened in Rwanda was our weakness, failure of internal structures, but that does not exonerate you. So you must go back and rebuild so that you can be seen as a serious country. Because your failure to protect people who come to you, it just simply signifies that you can no longer even protect your own people.
Well, interesting, right? That you talk about protecting our own people. I am very interested to know, if we have had this major failing of the SANDF on foreign soil, and here at home, we have many of our own problems. I think back to 2021, when we had a major eruption. Can South Africa's defense force protect South Africans internally?
No. And the answer for that is because that's not their responsibility. If you look at the Defense Act, you look at our constitution, and you remember everything that happened under the old government, we specifically set up SANDF not to be used internally. It is not a law enforcement agency, and to use it internally overstretches it. And If you think of SANDF as a knife, to use it as a spade, just blunt it. It is not their job. When they've got the budget of 59 billion and SAPS is getting 133 billion, why should they go help SAPS? SAPS is more than double their size, and it's SAPS's role to enforce the law and to protect and to do internal security and to protect the public, not SANDF's
role. Well, we have seen our president deploying soldiers on South African ground, whether it is to protect infrastructure, as they've said with Eskom, whether it is, I mean, a lot of, and much has been said about during the pandemic as well and the deployment, or whether it's in the Cape Flats. You know, those kinds of exercises. Do you think that even though the Act does not allow for it, can we? Even foreign invasion, you were talking about Mozambique, thinking about Moshabos. What are they called?
Machado.
Al-Shabaab, right?
Al-Shabaab,
yeah. In Mozambique. And the failings there of the SANDF. Are we vulnerable as a country?
We are very vulnerable. The porous nature of our borders is, it's just unpoliceable, in my opinion. You've got a riverbed between us and Zimbabwe that is on a good year with heavy rainfall like we've had now. 45 to 60 days of the year, there'll be a river there. The rest of the time, it's a dry riverbed. In my visits up there, you know, SANDF takes you up to the riverbank and you get, then you'll see people sitting in the middle of the river and you wonder, what are they doing there? And soldiers will tell you, no, they're just waiting for us to leave because they know we can't do anything until they actually get to this side. But they can't be everywhere. We've got 206-kilometer border with Zimbabwe that is patrolled by about 250, 300 soldiers. So our entire northern border section is one infantry battalion, and you've got one company for Botswana, one company for Zimbabwe, and then one company for Mozambique, and then you've got a headquarters company. It's not enough. But even if we put all of our troops there, I don't think they would be able to do anything, because as long as the people on the other side have a reason to cross and as long as the geography stays the same, it's not a problem we can solve with the army. But back to the point, in 2008, I believe, SANDF was pulled away from the border and had its personnel count and its budget decreased because it gave up the responsibility. And it was given to SAPS, who then failed to effectively conduct that responsibility. And the decision was reversed, but the budget decision was not reversed. And we see this in a lot of other places. Also, when we look at the maintenance of SANDF's 34,000 buildings, that was part of Public Works, who then did not maintain those buildings. And when it went to Public Works, the budget was decreased. Now that it's come back, the budget has not been reassessed. So you end up with this defense force that is being asked to do so much and is being treated like a Swiss Army knife, when it actually isn't. It's a very, very specific tool that has a very, very specific purpose, but one that the government has failed to recognize and explain to the public. SANDF is not a law enforcement agency. If you send them into the Cape Flats, yeah, they're going to keep the area secure while they're there because they're going to be walking around with their rifles. But they're not trained to arrest people, to interact with the public. They are trained to do combat operations.
Well, the one thing that we're not going to be able to end this conversation without talking about, Frank, it is a growing dissatisfaction in the populace of South Africa, particularly in townships. We see what's happening in Durban and Addington with primary schools and the idea that refugees from all over the continent have become a heavy burden on the state and on South Africans, so much so that they get preferential treatment from the South African government. Because, as you said earlier, the government has an international obligation to look after people who come to their country looking for help. How do we move forward then? If South Africa is unable and the SADC region is unable to find a diplomatic solution to the conflicts on the continent, and we are unable to have a military solution to the conflicts on the continent, how then can the South African public understand how this impacts them, and what's the future? Is there a solution, or is this our new normal?
I think the solutions are always there. Thus, if you want to think in terms of solutions, you always find solutions. But if you want to think in terms of problems, you'll have enough of them. This is what I mean. See, one time I was on ETV and they told me about, are South Africans xenophobic or not? And I categorically said no. The reason being that do not look at political confusion or people who are fighting for little resources and you term that xenophobic. If it was, you would find that every foreigner where they are being attacked. The fact of the matter that we are all here, welcomed by friendly South Africans, that rules out that. Now, let's go to what would be the solution and how would the South Africans understand this in the bigger context. Now, this is leadership. Leadership must be not, we must not escape our responsibilities because of challenges. South Africa has a challenge. Why? As I started by saying that this is one of the most stable democracies on African continent, which still respects human rights, rule of law, justice is still working. So what does that mean? People feel safe where they feel they can be protected. But then, now we look at the population of South Africa, which is struggling internally. And then they feel like, no, the attention has been put to the foreigners. But now, without proper explanation, sensitizing the population that, look, there are internal challenges, but there are international obligations to meet. Now, if you create jobs and there are enough jobs to go around, you won't have people fighting for, you won't find such an employment. Because it would be a misdirection to say people don't have jobs because of foreigners. What kind of jobs are actually foreigners taking? The unemployment is not caused by the foreigners. No, it's simply because it's either bad policies or something that is not happening. And then when people are poor, they will always find reasons who is basically, because otherwise there is always enough to go around as long as people have been given that freedom to create and the government has created a platform for people to thrive. So now, the future solution for me that I believe is South Africa has to be firm on its international policy. You cannot have a quiet diplomacy solution and you have all African countries destabilized and you expect to be stable into your own yard. It won't happen. You cannot be an island in turbulent water. It won't happen. So what would have happened? He said that, what did we get out of that mission in DRC? What was achieved? In the first place, you went there to silence or to keep the peace. Now you went out without even explaining what did you achieve. So what does that mean? You left the chaos even worse than you went there. So what does that mean? The refugees are going to follow you. And guess what? They are going to give you the same burden in your own country. So South Africa has to be firm in terms of how it deals with other African countries so that they can be stable. And then those refugees, if their countries are stable, they're going to be no such influx of refugees.
You're raising an interesting point. And I think as a last question, Ricardo, do you think that South Africa needs to be re-examining its foreign policy in alignment with its defense priorities?
Yes.
And capabilities?
I think we need to be taking ourselves a lot more seriously and realize the gravity of the environment that we find ourselves in. And I think also when we look at South Africa's foreign policy, if we look now at Exercise Will for Peace that we just had in early Jan with Russia, China and Iran, it is a clear example of where the ANC conflates its own foreign policy with South Africa's foreign policy. And I think it needs to realize that what is in the best interest of the ANC is not always in the best interest of the country and the region. And they need to be a lot more pragmatic and a lot more serious at looking at the region. Going back to what you said earlier about there being no military solutions, I think there's no military solution to our border crises. But to some of the conflicts on the continent, there are military solutions. If we look at Sudan, I think there is a military solution to the RSF, and it involves a lot more bombs being dropped on them, particularly before they go near any other cities or villages. But again, with Rwanda, seeing everything that's happened in the region, I think Rwanda understands force, and in the world we live in now, diplomacy and rhetoric are empty without force. You can't just have the carrot and the handshake. You need to have the stick and the knife in your pocket. And we need to take ourselves a lot more seriously and realize that, you know, the principle of deterrence rests on two pillars. It's capability and credibility. And you can't have one without the other. our performance in the Eastern DRC and in Exercise War for Peace has damaged our credibility because of the underfunding of capability. So you need both in order to be taken seriously. We need to be able to fund our defense forces properly, to have a well-equipped, well-funded, clearly purposed defense force with a very clear mandate and very clear goals for any mission they do. And I think if we get there and we take ourselves very seriously and we can get back to the point where if we say we're going to send some troops in, that everybody sits up straight and goes, ooh, we don't want that. Let's deal with them. Let's behave. I think we need to take ourselves more seriously and to realize the power that lies within having a credible defense force. The president, ahead of the G20, in an attempt to take a dig at Donald Trump, said, you know, it cannot be that a country's economy or army determines who has a voice. But it very much does. That's the principle of foreign policy. That's why gunboat diplomacy exists. And I think if we, again, start funding our defense force properly and then realize that we have strategic assets like submarines and fighter jets and frigates and special forces that if, say, Rwanda starts behaving belligerently in the region, you know, we have something Rwanda doesn't have, which is a very, very, very capable fleet of fighter jets. Just a low flyover to give them a bit of a shock and remind them, hey, we can reach out into the region. We can do precision strikes. We have intelligence capabilities to know where all your assets and all your capabilities are, and we can hit them before you can realize we're coming. When we can do that, people will take us a lot more seriously. And then when the president comes in and wants to talk, people will listen.
Speaking of listening, as a political leader in exile, what would victory look like for you in Rwanda? What does a win look like, both politically and militarily, for the region and for the Congo-DRC conflict, the Congo-Rwanda conflict?
Thank you once again. I think we really do not ask the extraordinary things. What would it look like? Number one, you're saying Congo. We do not believe that Rwanda should be perpetually feeding on Congo, militarily aggressing Congo, because at the end of the day, it's the millions of Congolese and Rwandans who are dying at the expense, enrichment of one man who is President Paul Kagame. Another Rwanda that we would love to see is a democratic Rwanda where freedom of expression is exercised without repercussion of death or disappearance. Would love to see a Rwanda whereby the nations, the natives of Rwanda, or the people who live in Rwanda can be able to interact without fear of being harassed or killed. We would love to see a Rwanda whereby elections mean that people can have a voice and determine their leadership. Where in Rwanda today, you have a president who says he gets 99% after competing with himself. Whoever raises a voice is dead or has disappeared. That's not the country that we want. We would love a country whereby has a bilateral relationship with other countries without following whoever that is opposing you to be killed in whichever city you are in. So basically, we are not asking anything extraordinary. We are asking that, can Rwandans coexist in peace? Can they determine their lives? Can they chart their own future without fear of being harassed? You are here interviewing me. If you are in Rwanda, you would be going out here when you're going to jail or disappearing. I mean, that's not a country that we want. There are no human rights bodies in Rwanda as we speak. Amnesty International shown the door, Human Rights Watch gone. So this is a country where the only journalism in Rwanda is the one that praises the president. So clearly, the Rwanda that we want is a country whereby we can have civil rights thriving, journalism doing its work, justice system functioning. Not when the president doesn't want you, they just say they give you whatever he has, he decides.
Is Donald Trump's peace between Tshisekedi and Kagame going to hold?
It won't.
It hasn't. No.
It hasn't.
I mean, they couldn't even give the document to each other. They wouldn't look at each other. I think that is another example of Trump thinking he's a peacemaker when really he's just forcing people to sit down and pretend to talk to each other. And as soon as he's out of the room, the fighting continues.
But is it not an indictment on how weak African is? I mean, you are saying these are African problems. And that's the disappointment that I have in South Africa, being the big boy on the continent. And you go to Congo, you are chased away by Rwanda. Then now they're running to Trump to come and say, hey, stop this. But this is a serious indictment on African leaders who cannot come together and say, no, if some one country is misbehaving, then he was saying that you must have the capacity to enforce what you're saying because you're given that right by the international law. That's why the international law is there. If you go beyond your own borders and you're misbehaving in such a way, there are sanctions. You see, otherwise you cannot say diplomatically your good foreign policy. Which foreign policy will be respected when it cannot be enforced?
Whew. I think a good place to end it because there's a lot of... we could go on for days. I could go on for days talking about some of these things. And I think one of the things that we don't do enough of is interrogate what Africa and African leaders are actually doing. And, you know, in South Africa, I agree with you. South Africa is a loud voice. South Africa is a big boy. But for some reason, Pretoria, Tshwane, seems to be not quite standing up to kind of and taking that mantle as it has done in the past with some of our other presidents. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. Thank you for coming in and sharing your knowledge with us. And I hope that for the listener and the viewer at home, this opens a door and asks some further questions for them. Thank you.